Hi, Father. When two people get married, their souls are joined and they become one. Then what effect would it have on the other partner if one of the partners lived a life of either vice or virtue? And then how would that affect their final resting place? And then is there anything in the catechism that has something to do with this type of issue?
Okay, let's try to unpack this, Steve. You know, this is the old theological adage, seldom affirm, never deny, always distinguish. So what we talk about in the two becoming one is a one flesh unity. You are one flesh in marriage. Now, you still uniquely have your individual souls. Now, they are obviously by choice intertwined. But I think it's fortunate that the church talks about a one flesh unity. This is scriptural language about what marriage is, because in the biblical understanding of being a bodily being is that we exist in space and time. So one way of thinking of being a bodily being is that we exist in space and time, and that, you know, marriage does end with death. So there is this sense of recognizing that this is a this worldly thing, though obviously all the good fruits of our human endeavor will be found again in the kingdom, freed from the tarnish of sin and death, as Gautama Spes teaches, so that there's some relationship between what we do here and hereafter. We have to be careful to say there is a discontinuity, too, between here and the hereafter, because in heaven there's neither marrying or giving in marriage. You with me so far?
Yes.
Yeah. So your souls are yours. In other words, as frightening as this sounds, it is possible that a husband can go to heaven and a wife not, and vice versa. A wife can go to heaven and her husband not. So our souls still remain ours to say yes or no to God's will with that. Now, that being said, you're correct that that one flesh unity does have a real impact. And what one does for good or ill does affect the other for good or ill. And we have to be cognizant of that. That's why it's even more incumbent upon a husband, for example, to live chastely. It's more incumbent upon him to be a virtuous man and to fulfill his obligations as laying down his life for his wife and, if they have children, for their children. So it becomes more incumbent, because now if he did sin, not only is that effect on him directly, but it affects his wife and his children. So he has even more responsibility taking on that role in this one flesh unity with his spouse.
Okay, so it's not much different than, say, the mystical body of Christ. So that if someone is virtuous, they can build up the kingdom, or the opposite if they're not virtuous.
Right. It's not much different, but the closeness makes it. So, for example, you can imagine the pressure that would be put on a spouse by the other if the person wanted to be unchaste, for example, in some way. I'm not going to go into details because it's a family show. But you know what I'm talking about. If they, you know, wanted to view inappropriate things or do inappropriate things or use inappropriate devices, you can get, you know, fill in the blanks. So you can imagine that the closeness makes it, you know, what the technical term for this in theology is scandalous. Scandalous behavior leads the other astray. So, for example, when parents don't go to Mass, not only do they sin by not going to Mass, but they are scandalous in setting a terrible example for their children, who don't sin because they can't make the choice for themselves about going to Mass, but they objectively miss Mass and they've been led. And that makes that sin greater than the single person who doesn't go to Mass. That affects them, but it doesn't affect others the way that a husband or a wife affects their family.